I just love seeing you all come in like this.
He's talking about the new refiners joining the Severed Patreon page. Just $5 a month and no cranial drill required. Go to patreon.com/severedpod.
Okay, you're all set.
Severed, the ultimate severance podcast.
Welcome back, Refiner. You know it's true. Every time you find yourself here, it means you chose to come back. You're just in time for more Severed, the Ultimate Severance Podcast. I'm your host, Alan S. It's time for another installment of Severed Origins, but this time is a bit different. This is more of a navel-gazing episode because we're looking at a piece that's actually a part of the Severance canon. It's not an origins piece per se, but it was something designed to lay the groundwork for the series. It's called The Lexington Letter, and I probably should have gone over it a long time ago. It was released as a free downloadable document from the Apple Books app. If you have an Apple product, books came loaded with it. Fire up the Books app and do a search for The Lexington Letter, written by Anonymous. It's still available and still free. If you're on another mobile platform, you can download the Books app for free from your device's online store. Also, just in case you can't come up with any of that, I've converted the Lexington Letter and the orientation booklet into easy-to-use PDFs. Links to the two separate files are in the podcast show notes. As always, Refiners, soul-crushing spoilers ahead for the Lexington Letter. You really should have already read it by now, but if you haven't, get ready, because I'm going to ruin it for you. I mentioned the Lexington Letter the very first thing in episode 1 of the Severed podcast. I compared it to the booklets that used to come with graphic adventure games like Myst. At the time, I told you to go find it and read it, but that was the extent of my comments on the matter. I guess I did kind of leave you on your own when it came to interpreting the Lexington Letter. My apologies. I would like to thank patron refiner Sandy, who wondered on the Patreon page why I'd never broken down the Lexington Letter. The truth, as I told Sandy, I never gave it a thought. Since I like to edit audio clips into my commentary, a printed piece didn't jump out at me as a great choice for the podcast. But Sandy did have a point. Oh, and if you're wondering, this is the kind of thing we're getting into at patreon.com/severedpod. For just $5 a month, you could be in on selecting podcast topics. Once again, that's patreon.com/severedpod. The Lexington Letter isn't providing us with any groundbreaking information. It's also not all that well written, and it's loaded with continuity and logic errors. I guess you can partially chalk the quality of the writing up to who is supposed to have written it. The letter's author is an on-the-run former school bus driver who was a Severed employee in Topeka, Kansas. One of the reasons I think I was able to easily toss it aside is because I've never believed the Lex letter held any big secrets. You don't even have to read it in order to enjoy the series. The letter's primary purpose was to help the audience further understand the concept of severance. Still, there are a couple of small clues contained within the letter. I decided to reconsider this idea about breaking down the Lexington Letter, and I came up with a podcast way to approach it. The letter was written by a woman named Margaret Peg Kincaid. Her innie is, of course, Peggy K. I got to thinking, what if I had a female voice read various bits of the letter? Those could be my edited-in audio clips. And I just happen to know a talented and experienced female voice performer, my wife, Donna.
Hi.
Donna has agreed to provide the voice of the letter's author, Peg Kincaid, as we go through the breakdown of the Lexington Letter. Before we begin to examine the contents, let's take a real-world look at the Lexington Letter. What is it, and where did it come from? There's no author credit. It only shows as Anonymous on Apple Books. We've been told it was written by Ben Stiller as supplemental Severance content. I'm guessing Ben was not the only cook in the kitchen. Once we get into it, it becomes pretty obvious there were multiple changes and rewrites. Many of them were not very well executed. The release date on Apple Books shows it is dropping on March 18th of 2022, exactly 1 month after the premiere of the first two episodes. I have also seen articles where it was mentioned the Lex Luthor dropped before the first episode, but I can't find any confirmation supporting this timeline. Either way, the letter and a copy of the newly severed employee handbook were both made very available to the general watching public early in the run of the series. There were several news stories published on March 18th talking about the release of the document. This lends credence to March 18th as being the actual release date. The big question coming right behind what is it would be why? Why would the production company go to the trouble of creating and releasing this additional document? Well, it's simple. They were worried about people understanding the severance concept. I mentioned this numerous times throughout the first couple of episodes. The suits at Apple TV were worried no one would watch if they couldn't grasp the concept. Since they were having trouble understanding themselves, they figured we wouldn't get it either. This is why various characters keep repeating the specifics of the procedure over and over.
Well, it's simple. One's memories are bifurcated, so when you're not at work, you have no recollection of what it is you do there. Did I get that right, Mark?
There was this huge worry behind the scenes that the whole thing was just too weird for the average viewer to get their brain around. The producers thought the concept of severance was too hard to decipher. They felt unless the concept was explained repeatedly and in excruciating detail, nobody was going to understand what was going on. Sluggish first month download numbers made this worry even more pronounced. The Lexington Letter was produced as a direct result of this concern. It is a very detailed explanation of the procedure and the effects of the procedure on an individual. It also alludes to things like code sensors, heightened security, and even clues as to what might really be happening down in MDR when numbers are refined. The letter is actually an internal email thread from the Topeka Star newspaper in Topeka, Kansas. We're able to see the notes traded between a reporter and her editor regarding this interesting letter she received. The reporter includes the body of the letter along with an introductory email. Topeka is a city of 126,000 located due west of Kansas City in northeastern Kansas. It's located right at 1,250 miles from the Bell Labs complex in Homedale, New Jersey. Topeka does have a daily newspaper, the Topeka Capital Journal. It's published by Gannett News Service. The Topeka Star, which sounds like a legit name for a newspaper, does not exist. It is a fictional publication created for our story. The reporter is Daria, the manager is Jim. Both go by last initials in their emails, just like Innie's. We have Daria T and Jim M identified right at the top of the letter. The original email sent to Jim from Daria is dated November 12th, but no year is given. Daria says she got the attached letter from a Lumen employee. She also scanned the employee handbook, which is mentioned in the letter. Daria admits the whole thing's pretty out there, but she thinks the story sounds interesting. She's asking her editor, Jim, if she should pursue it. The letter is addressed to Daria Thorne, so there's our T. The original letter from Peg is dated November 10th.
Dear Ms. Thorne, my name is Peg Kincaid. Until yesterday, I was an employee at Lumen Industries here in Topeka. I'm writing on behalf of myself and my friend, Peggy Kay, who is now no longer with us. Maybe it's strange to call her my friend, but it's how I think of her. Depending on how much you know about Lumen and what they do, maybe you already know what I mean.
This last line indicates Lumen may have had other information leaked about their operation. Based on Daria's reactions in her email to Jim, I don't think she has a clue as to what Peggy means. Also, make a mental note. Peg says she worked at Lumen up until yesterday. We will get to the events of yesterday a little later in the letter. Peg mentions being impressed with Daria's thorough coverage of something she calls the Dorner truck incident from November 3rd. My initial assumption when she mentioned this date was that the Dorner truck incident had happened 1 week before the date on her letter. As we'll discover, this isn't even close. Peg does mention she'd considered going to the cops.
But people say Lumen has a lot of connections with the police and City Hall, so I don't think they would believe me anyway. I hope you believe me. I really need someone to believe me.
It sounds like Lumen's influence is not limited to the city of Kyr. They have their tentacles buried in the local control structures wherever they have locations. Peg then says she's going to give Daria the full story. She does warn us about getting rambly when she's nervous, and oh my, does she get rambly. Peg is currently holed up in a motel. She's worried she's being watched or followed or something. There's no proof, just a nagging feeling about something being off. She had this sense that someone was digging through her mail before she got to it. The same black cars are always parked next to hers. It made her nervous enough she felt like she had to move out of her home. Peg then goes into her history prior to the job at Lumen, which she started 2 years ago. She'd been a bus driver for Clover Elementary down off Route 2. She's been there for about 12 years and says she really loved her job. Why would Ben Stiller make Peg a bus driver? I think it's because of the everyman nature of her job. Driving a school bus is not a high-paying job, and it doesn't require a college degree. Driving a bus does require strict attention to safety and a dedication to your work. Being dedicated to what you're doing and following rules are two of the key hallmarks of a good Lumen Innie.
At some point, the kids learned I was the youngest driver on the payroll, even though I was already 50, so they gave me the nickname Baby Driver, a reference to the beloved action film of the same name.
Although we aren't given a year on the letter or in the email headers, this reference does give us a starting point for a rough timeline. Let's extrapolate and make a few wild guesses. The movie she mentions, Baby Driver, came out in June of 2017. Since it would have been on the students' minds that fall, I'm betting they gave Peg her new nickname in the fall of 2017. This timeline works when it comes to explaining when, but the movie itself really doesn't work here. Peg said she drives for elementary school kids. Baby Driver is a pretty hard R with heavy violence and adult language throughout. Yeah, so maybe a few of the 5th and 6th graders might have snuck it past mom and dad, but I don't think this was a widely watched movie among the elementary crowd. So with this nickname story, we're able to peg Peg as driving a bus in the fall of 2017. This incident which made her give up bus driving happened in February. Could it have been February of 2018? I would say probably. It was a cold day, as is usual for February in Kansas. Peg was nearing the end of her afternoon route.
That's when, through no fault of my own, my bus hit black ice. I pumped the brakes as per protocol, but our momentum kept us sliding. For the first time in my career in child transpo, I landed my rig in a ditch.
No one was hurt, but the experience was alarming enough to cause Peg to reconsider her career. It really shook her up. Kids were crying, scared, cold.
We had 3 urination events, which in the low temperature proved to be an issue.
The kids were retrieved by another bus. Peg stayed with her rig waiting on a tow. While listening to the radio and trying to stay warm, she had an epiphany. She thought to herself, F this job. She thinks she may have even said it out loud. Weirdly, right at that moment, Peg heard an employment recruiting ad on the bus radio. It was talking about a job in vague terms.
There was a lot of flowery talk about making history and rethinking the notion of work. I was sort of tuning out until the end when they said the name of the company, Lumen Industries.
Were there microphones or security cameras on the bus? Is Lumen somehow reading people's minds? Peg says she knew the name Lumen. She'd been using their deodorant since puberty, but she didn't know they had a branch in Topeka. I slipped into a weird little conspiracy theory here. Put on your tinfoil hats, refiners. This is out there. It was the mention of the deodorant that sent me down this particular rabbit hole. I've heard the horror stories about aluminum from antiperspirants collecting in the body. It's a very tiny amount, but some aluminum is absorbed through the skin every time you apply an antiperspirant. Peg specifically mentioned using a deodorant, not an antiperspirant, so it's probably nothing, but this was my crazy conspiracy theory thought. What if Lumen's been transferring something from their toiletry products through the skin of consumers, which allows them to read the minds of their customers? Okay, yeah, it's out there, but so is Lumen. It's also a little like the Joker's plan from the original 1989 Tim Burton Batman. the radio playing this commercial at the exact moment Peg is considering a life change reeks of those suggest sell ads popping up in your browser window, or Alexa listening in on our conversations. Sure, it's creepy and intrusive, but I don't see it being outside the realm of Lumen's capabilities.
I remember thinking, well, that was weird.
After getting towed, Peg says she arrived home 5 hours late, only to find an angry voicemail from her boss. This sealed it. It was definitely time for Peg Kincaid to find a new job. The next day, while she was out, Peg passed by what she called the new Lumen site. It had been under construction for several months. Yeah, building a severed floor is going to take some time and effort. Something pulled Peg in. She had a memory of that spot she'd heard on the bus radio.
Even though I had ice cream in the trunk, I found myself turning into the parking lot. I parked and went in.
Peg did not consider herself a candidate for a position at a high-tech joint like Lumen. She'd done a few semesters at Kansas State, but she'd never graduated. Kansas State University was founded in 1863 in Manhattan, Kansas, as the first public institution of higher learning in the state. KSU is home of the Wildcats.
The nice Lumen lady who greeted me told me that didn't matter. She said I could get a great office job, incredible benefits, manageable hours, and all I had to do was this tiny little procedure called severance.
Peg then says, "You probably know what that is." Well, around here, the severance procedure is very well known. It's discussed openly on the news, at no dinner dinners, even out on dates.
Like, you could have a girlfriend at Lumen and not know it. And if you met someone out here, you wouldn't know it in there.
Everybody seems to know about severance at the home base, but is it as well known across the country? Peg seems to think so, although 2 years ago when she was first signing up, she didn't have a clue about what it was.
It took them longer than it probably should have to explain it to me. They told me that after a screening process, I'd have a small, totally painless chip inserted in my brain.
The term screening process caught my attention. I'm curious who they're turning down for the severance procedure. It seems like everybody gets in. We've got disturbed widowers, depressed divorcees, repressed gay men, and they're all severed. I'd love to know what goes into one of these screenings and just who are they weeding out. Maybe we need a spinoff show about those people. Peg loves the idea of turning off her brain for work. She introduces the term innie and describes the day-to-day workings of the chip.
No memory of work and 4 times the pay. Despite it being quite a drastic procedure, all that made it feel like, well, a no-brainer.
Peg went for it. She got severed. They even gave her a 4-cheese panini afterwards. What a great place to work. Or at least she thought so for the next 2 years. As a time frame, we're probably looking at a period going from the spring or early summer of 2018 through the fall of 2020. A couple of times she throws out 2 years for how long she worked at Lumen. It's probably more like 2.5 years, but the last big time milestone she passed was 2 years, so that's become the shorthand answer. 2 years is also roughly the same length of time Mark S. has been severed. Is it possible there's a restlessness that sets in with an innie at around 2 years after being severed? Do innies suffer from the terrible twos?
You've been severed for 2 years, right? So your innie really is still just a baby.
Peg tells Daria she loved the severed lifestyle. She describes going to work, changing into what she calls Lumen Neutrals, the Topeka term for code detector safe clothes. And yes, Peg does mention the highly debated code detectors. Based on what's going to happen, I don't think the code detection technology was quite as advanced as what we're familiar with at the Cure location of Lumen. I believe it exists, but I also think it's evolving.
There's code detectors.
Did you know that? Have you tried? Because frankly, it sounds made up.
Peg describes how, in the middle of her elevator ride, the chip would switch over to nothing. Sweet, sweet nothing. Peg knew her chip was switching over to her innie, but she didn't equate anything negative with being an innie.
It was this whole other personality with no memory of my life here in Topeka. She could walk and talk and all of that, but she didn't remember, say, my third grade teacher's name, or me falling off a horse and breaking my arm when I was 8, or when my ex-husband told me he wanted a divorce. Lucky girl.
Peg never concerned herself with this other. She describes her as being me, but not me. If your innie hasn't submitted a request or sent a video demanding to be freed, like what Heliar did, it's probably pretty easy to forget about them. Peg did.
Eventually, we all have to accept reality.
She loved disconnecting each day during her ride in the elevator. At the end of the workday, she might be a little tired, but otherwise, she had no idea what went into earning her paycheck.
And that's how it went, day in and day out, for 2 years, until one particular Tuesday when I messed it all up. Or actually, we messed it all up.
Peg says she got off the elevator and went to her locker like any normal day. It wasn't until she was pulling on her jacket that she discovered something in her pants pocket. This was a big surprise because, as we all know, you're not supposed to bring anything onto or off of the severed floor. What she found was a half sheet of typing paper. Before telling us what's on the paper, Peg backs up a bit. She fills us in with some backstory about her sister, Meryl. Meryl, spelled just like Truman's wife's name in The Truman Show, was 11 months older than Peggy. They were even born in the same year. Peggy said they've grown apart recently, but the two sisters were very close as kids.
In fact, we were so close that we invented a secret language together called Puglish. We'd write long letters to each other about which boys we liked or teachers we hated in Puglish so no one else could understand.
What they'd created was a simple symbol replacement system. Instead of letters, they created symbols used one-to-one, replacing each letter in the alphabet. A was a seahorse, B was a lightning bolt. She says they even used a pair of boobs for X. Peggy hadn't written or even thought of Puglish for more than 30 years. It all came flooding back to her when she opened that half sheet of paper. It was covered with rows of seahorses, lightning bolts, and the other symbols from her childhood sister language. Once Peg had a chance to sit with it for a few minutes, she said her memory of the code came flooding back. She was able to read it easily.
Dear Peggy K, I don't know what language this is, or why it's in my head. It's been coming to me slowly over the past few weeks. I find myself writing it at my desk. I thought if anyone would know what it was, maybe it would be you.
Both Peg and Peggy K tapped into a type of memory that's referred to as procedural. Procedural memory is the you never forget how to ride a bike memory. When procedural memories are formed, they get implanted in the subconscious. Creating a procedural memory is kind of like programming a macro task in a word processor. It's a shorthand way of executing certain sequences, especially repetitive movements like pedaling. When you're on a bike, you don't think about each and every push of your foot on the pedals. You just pedal. Your brain already knows what to tell your legs and feet to do thanks to procedural memory. Your subconscious takes care of the pedaling and balancing, leaving your conscious mind free to do other things like watch for traffic or maybe listen to a podcast. Dexterity tasks like knitting are also usually stored in the subconscious as procedural memory. This ability to access just any procedural memory feels like a potential flaw in the severance chip. We've already deduced from some of Irv's dream issues that the chip can't control the subconscious. The chip is only dealing with splitting conscious memories. Since procedural memory is stored in the subconscious, the chip doesn't seem to be able to suppress or control access to it. This is great when it comes to things like walking, talking, and going to the bathroom. You wouldn't want an innie to forget those procedural memories. But it does present a problem when the innies are able to access a procedural memory for something unpredictable, like in the case of writing and reading a secret language. Peggy's Puglish note continues. She isn't even sure if it'll get through the code detectors, but she says she has to try. She introduces herself as Peg Kincaid's innie. She says she lives in MDR with three other coworkers. This phrase is interesting for a couple of reasons. First off, she says she lives in MDR, not works there. She considers herself to be living there. Also, she is part of a four-person MDR department. This raises the question, are all MDR departments made up of four people? Is it necessary to have four refiners in order to balance out the four tempers? In her Puglish letter, Innie Peggy K asked many of the same questions posed by Mark S. Why do I exist? Why would a person choose to get severed? And what's it like out there? Peggy isn't even sure this language is real, but if it is, she would love for Peg to write her back. She knows it's a breach of protocol and could get her in big trouble, but she would really love a return letter.
I understand if that is not possible. I do not mean any harm. Sincerely, your any, Peggy K.
Peg says this note knocked her on her ass. Up to that point, she really hadn't given much thought to her any. I think this is pretty common among severed employees. Unless the outie is confronted with something like a written request to quit or a video from their any, I doubt an outie really gives much thought to their any.
I knew she was down there doing her thing, but part of what I loved so much about this whole severance thing is that I didn't need to think about it.
She'd been told during training how much her any would act like a child. She tells Daria she was surprised to see how obvious this was in the note.
I stared at that note for the rest of the night. I thought of her, or me, or a different version of me, I guess, down there in the dark on the severed floor, clearly desperate for more information.
Outie Peg Kincaid was torn about what to do with this note. She loved her job and didn't want to mess it up. Swapping messages with her any could definitely mess things up. It was a direct violation of severed employee rules. Peg was also a bit surprised that a code developed by a couple of second graders would be sophisticated enough to fool the code detectors. Maybe it was the simplicity that allowed it to get by. Peg does mention the code detection was a new technology. If code detection was new in about 2020, this means there were several years we know of when this severed program was in place and they didn't have code detectors. Innies and outies may have been in more contact with each other than management realized back in the days prior to the code detectors. The communication between innies and outies must have been getting out of hand if it forced Lumen to both create the code detection tech and outfit their severed elevators with it. Peg then says there's a part of her that wishes she'd just called her manager and reported this rule-breaking note. Her manager is a Mr. Alvarado, most likely the Topeka version of Seth Milchick. She had noticed the work was leaving her with some strange feelings at the end of the day.
I'd come out of the elevator feeling, I don't know, different than I'd ever felt before. Maybe a little giddy or sometimes all wound up or scared even. And it made me wonder, what were they doing down there with my body?
We know from observing Helly as she was going through training that certain numbers can instill these feelings in the refiner.
The numbers were scary.
Any Peggy K was having the same experiences as our crew, only on the Topeka severed floor. Peg didn't want to mess up her job, but she was just too curious. She had to know what was going on down there. The day after finding the note, she decided to write back. It would just be the once and just to ask what it is she does down on the severed floor.
She wrote back right away. I got a message in my pocket that next night. She told me that she worked as a macro data refiner.
Which didn't mean anything to Peg. Her any went into detail, describing the process of putting special numbers into bins.
That's a job? And I'm making four times as much as when I was driving a bus?
Of course, the any communication wasn't just once. As soon as Peg realized she and Peggy could communicate, they wrote each other more and more often. Maybe not every day, but almost. Peg asked for more of a description of what Peggy was doing with the numbers. Her response sounds pretty familiar. We've been through the number sorting process at the Cure offices. We know how it works. Peggy does say what we all suspected. The MA, or malice numbers, are the angry, scary ones. She also describes the numbers as kind of throbbing a certain emotion at you. Peggy then tells Peg about her work environment. She talks about how the files are completed, the melon bar. She even mentions the music dance experience and the waffle party. All of the tricks used for training and maintaining on the severed floor seem to be the same here in Topeka as they are in Cure PE. Just like we saw with the intake preamble, these processes for working with innies have been painstakingly developed over the years. If something worked in Cure, you'd definitely want to use it in Topeka. I do wonder if Topeka also has a perpetuity wing. If not, where do they hold the waffle parties?
I hope they at least get different kinds of syrups to go along with those waffles.
Peggy was as curious about the outside world as Peg was about the nature of the work.
She wanted to know everything about outside life, like what it felt like to be drunk or asleep. I'd never thought of it before, but she'd never been asleep because I do all of that on the outside.
Peg could see how the severance chip was filtering Peggy Kay's knowledge. Peggy knew what beer was, but couldn't name a specific brand. She knew she lived in America, but couldn't draw a map of it. She knew about the existence of movies, but she didn't know David Niven, who was one of Audi Peg's favorites. Peggy also asked if Peg had ever regretted getting severed.
To be honest, I hadn't, until I thought more about her sitting down there in the dark.
The communication between Innie and Audi continued for 3 or 4 weeks, according to Peg. They didn't pass notes daily, but Peg said it was enough for her to start to think of this other consciousness as a new friend. Peggy loved to hear details about Audi life. Peg started doing things with Peggy in mind.
Once I painted my nails hot pink, which is not really my style, just to see what she'd think. That night, she wrote me back saying tears had sprung to her eyes. Our nails were so beautiful.
The stories of their communication go on and on. Peg admits she's rambling. She's so edgy, she writes that housekeeping at her motel just knocked and it made her yell. Even though both Peg and Peggy were concerned they would get caught, nothing came of it. They continued to pass their puglish notes without incident. Peggy did mention the head of security, a Mr. Dooley, who seemed to be taking more of an interest in her lately. He would be standing at the end of the hall when she'd leave, just smiling his terrifying smile. Dooley must be Doug Grainer's counterpart at the severed operation in Topeka. Unlike Doug, it sounds like Dooley can smile. I wonder if he also has access to the bad soap.
There's bad soap.
Peggy even mentions the break room. She doesn't provide any details, but Peg can tell it's a topic that makes Peggy uncomfortable.
On you go.
The notes continue as the code detectors remain clueless. Okay, refiner, breather. Up to here, this letter makes sense, and I'm following along. Aside from the code detectors missing something that is obviously code, I'm on board with the story. From here on out, this letter gets really rickety. Details are wrong, timelines are distorted, and the logic just doesn't add up. I think it's because this piece was rushed by the producers. They wanted to get it out to boost downloads, so they didn't pay a whole lot of attention to the details. I'll get into it as we go along, but be ready if you read it closely at all. It doesn't make sense. Okay, breather over. Back to work. Peg then catches us up to November 3rd.
Which is why I'm writing to you in the first place.
And here is the start of this huge time problem. The date on the Topeka Star emails starts on November 12th. We don't have a year, but we do have this date, which is very much in our faces. The big Lexington file completion and the explosion, which we'll get to in just a moment, happened on November 3rd. It's a big deal, so Peg is very specific about that date. Based on these two dates, it feels like we're supposed to deduce that this event happened 9 days ago. I think at some point in the drafting of this story, it was an event that happened 9 days ago, but details obviously changed. November 3rd being just 9 days ago is not remotely possible based on the rest of Peg's story. We're going to hit passages where Peg talks about weeks and weeks passing after the file completion day. Either it's been a whole year and 9 days since the Lexington file was completed, or we've got an author who didn't pay attention to the internal timeline details of their story. At the end of the day, on Friday, November 3rd, Audi Peg came to in the severed elevator as usual. There was a note from Peggy saying she'd completed a file.
You have brought glory to this company and to me, Keir Egan.
She was very excited about it. The file name was Lexington, and she'd finished it at 2:30 p.m. This reaction struck me as a little weird. Peg's been working there for 2+ years. Peggy's surely completed other files in that time. I don't know why she would be so excited about this one file, but maybe this one is somehow different, or maybe it's the first one she's finished since they've been communicating. According to Peggy Kay, this particular file was complicated and exhausting. Audi Peg says she'd been aware. She could tell by the way she felt fried at the end of each day this past week. Not on this day, though. This day, she says she felt jazzed, full of energy. She even went for a jog when she got home from work.
Later that same night, I'm watching TV and I see you, Miss Thorne, on the news. Your face was as serious as I've ever seen it, your voice steadfast and resolute, as you reported about the truck that had been blown up in New York at 2:32 p.m. that day.
I warned you, gang, not only is this letter rickety, but now we've got huge continuity issues. I'm just certain we established Ms. Thorne as being a newspaper reporter. What's she suddenly doing on the TV news? It's common knowledge in journalism if you aren't pretty enough for TV, you write for the paper. As my father used to tell me, I've got a face for radio. I'm betting this story started out with Daria as a TV reporter. At some point during what seems to be a very rushed writing process, it was decided Peg should take her story to a print outlet instead. They changed it and cleaned up the TV references everywhere else, but somebody missed this one. Proofreading, such an underrated but valuable skill. Topeka does have an affiliate for all of the television networks, so Peg could have gone the TV route for her expose. Print probably makes more sense, but I have a bigger concern with the logic of anyone from Topeka reporting on this exploding truck story. Whether it's TV or print, no reporter from Topeka, Kansas is going to do a story on an incident that happened in New York City. If this truck explosion had happened on I-70, somewhere between Lawrence and Topeka, then Daria would have a legit story. As it is, this story would only be reported in Topeka by running a clip or a wire story from a national service. No way did Topeka send a local reporter to NYC to cover this story. The truck that had blown up belonged to a company called Dorner Therapeutics. Dorner, we're told, is a major competitor to Lumen. Peggy said she got a sick pit in her stomach when she considered the possible connection here.
I looked back at my earlier note from Peggy and read again when she'd completed the file. The time had been 2:30 p.m.
Yeah, okay, but these two things happened at the same time in different time zones. When it was 2:32 in New York, the time was 1:32 in Topeka. If Peggy had finished at 2:30 in Topeka, the truck in New York had already been blown up for an hour. Peg is trying to make the case that Peggy's completion of the Lexington file somehow caused the Dorner truck explosion. In order to buy this premise, we all have to agree to forget that the United States is divided into four time zones. Are you seeing why I didn't give a lot of attention to this letter? It really needed a proofreader. The explosion was horrible. People were burned alive. There are six total dead and no explanation as to who did it or why. Peg is certain there is a connection to Peggy's completion of the Lexington file.
It all seems like too much of a coincidence, doesn't it? Is that why these numbers are making the innies down there feel things? Because they're dropping bombs or blowing things up from down there?
If this is what MDR is really up to, then whoa. You'd never know it down on the severed floor in Kier. Peg says she barely slept that weekend. On Monday, she sent Peggy a note wanting more information about the Lexington file. She pressed her about the numbers. Peggy, like any good innie, had no answers. She did mention the work being very important, but we already knew that.
The work is mysterious and important.
There is some back and forth communication between them. This means days have to be passing. Each day, the maximum transaction would be one note in, one note out.
Finally, I worked up the nerve to tell her about the truck. It took me over an hour to write that note. I told her I couldn't be sure there was a connection, but that the timing felt too close to ignore.
Well, too close to ignore if you ignore the existence of time zones. Peg tells Peggy how Lumen may have used them both for something insidious and horrifying. After writing that note, Peg didn't hear back. She said a day passed, then three. This has to put us at least a week since the explosion, probably more. Peggy was definitely not responding, and it was worrying Peg. She talks about how strange it is to worry about your innie.
I was leaving each day without a scratch on me, and I was certainly still alive, which meant that physically, Peggy had to be fine. But her silence grew more terrifying as the days turned to weeks.
Did you hear that? Weeks? Really? If the days turn to weeks, we have to at least be into January by now. Peg wanted to write another note to Peggy, but she was worried about Lumen being onto them.
One Tuesday, I emerged to find my hair wet. A note on my windshield from Lumen informed me that my innie had had a visually comedic but painless mishap with the water cooler.
Visually comedic note aside, the wet hair implies she's being waterboarded. Waterboarding is horrific torture, but it does not leave a physical mark. Peggy may have been waterboarded for 8 straight hours. Peg was given a gift card to Murray's all-day breakfast buffet to make up for the wet hair. Not sure who Murray is. I was ready for another CEO name like Pips. The reward for any mishap here in Topeka sounds a lot like Mark's VIP seating, although Peg actually gets some free food out of the deal.
That night, over hash browns, my mind raced. What the hell were they doing to her down there each day? How could I help? Should I resign?
She repeats the comment we've heard from Mark. If she resigns, then Peggy K, the innie version of Peg Kincaid, essentially dies. Innies can't be accessed anywhere other than the severed floor, so if an outie stops coming to the floor, the innie ceases to exist.
Surely I couldn't do that, no matter how bad things had gotten.
There are two paths to this argument. Either you see quitting and leaving the severed floor as nothing more than shutting off a part of your own brain with memories you'll never be able to access. Or you see it as effectively killing another personality that lives within you. How you feel about quitting all depends on how you view your innie. The next paragraph starts, "It was 2 weeks later." As you can see, trying to construct a timeline from this letter is useless. Whenever it was, Peg was coming up the elevator for the evening when she felt something thick and firm tucked into her waistband.
I struggled to show no emotion as I went to my locker, retrieved my personal items, and went to my car.
Once Peg was safely away from Lumen property, she retrieved whatever it was Peggy had sent up the elevator. It was a spiral-bound booklet with a teal cover. This booklet is the other part of the Lexington letter document. The title on the front says the Macro Data Refiner's Orientation Booklet. We've seen Helly flipping through a copy of this booklet on the show. The whole thing, from cover to cover, is at the end of the Lexington letter document. I've also created a PDF of the orientation booklet as its own standalone document. You can find a link to that in the podcast show notes. There was also something else.
A note was taped to the front, written in the King's English in my very own handwriting. Duly found your last note. Been in the break room. Don't know how long. Think you're right about Lexington. Lumen updating code detectors, but they're down today. Hope this booklet gives clarity.
Dooley is who she mentioned as being head of security, but security seems a bit lax here in Topeka. If the code detectors were down at the Cure offices, I see Doug Grainer doing pat-downs just before the refiners got on the elevator. I don't see anyone spiriting this booklet out of the Cure office as easily as Peg did. There is some huge info contained in this note. Right about Lexington is a concerning phrase. Does this mean there are no time zones in the U.S.? Okay, that's my last reference to the time zone thing. From here on out, I'll let it drop. I think she's saying MDR is somehow doing something that mimics a terrorist attack. I don't know how Peggy K would be able to come across this information. Maybe she's been doing some sleuthing, or maybe it's just a feeling she's gotten since knowing about the explosion. Peg talks about meeting Sevi, the Severance Chip mascot, in the orientation booklet. Ultimately, she decides there's no real way to describe the orientation booklet. This is why she just includes it in her mailing. She did look closely, trying to determine what exactly the numbers really mean.
The only thing the handbook says about it is, "We know you may be curious about what the numbers mean. However, knowing the true meaning behind the numbers could inhibit your natural intuition." Well, my natural freaking intuition is telling me something horrible is happening here.
Another week passes without a word from Peggy. It's been months at least since the Dorner incident. Peg didn't write to her either, worried the updated code detectors might now be able to detect Puglish. Peg's story has now reached what she refers to as last Friday morning. Based on how she opened this letter, last Friday, from her perspective, was yesterday. She says in the first paragraph she was a Lumen employee up until yesterday, so the event she's about to describe just happened. Calling it last Friday makes it seem more distant. Peg had started to feel badly about going to work because of what she envisioned might be happening to Peggy. While sitting in her car yesterday morning, curiosity and concern got the better of her.
I did something that contradicted my better judgment. I grabbed a fast food receipt out of my cup holder and hurriedly wrote a note in Puglish. It was a very quick note. All it said was, "Are you okay?"
Peg was nervous, but she went on into work as usual. When she came back up the elevator, she said her heart was racing and her palms were sweaty, even though she didn't know why. Wow, if that was weird and disorienting, think about how awful it must have been for Audi Heli coming to hanging from a ceiling crossmember. Peg's watch said it was 9:10. She'd only been downstairs for about 10 minutes.
More troublingly, I felt a dry clump of something in my mouth.
This must have been at a time before the code detectors had been upgraded to the level they are at the Cure office.
Hey, just in case you find this relevant for some reason, the code detectors can read messages hidden inside the body as well.
You never really get a chance to test this one out, but Mark believes it's true. Of course, what's in Peg's mouth is a piece of paper. Once alone, back at her locker, she spits it out.
I opened it up and read, "Peg, leave now. Get somewhere safe. They will try to follow. Nothing they say is real. Distribute the training booklet. Answers are there if you look. Thank you for my life. You were the best part of it. I'll be with you always. Peggy K."
As soon as she read the note, Peg says she called Mr. Alvarado and quit. She also says she left Topeka without returning home. So this would mean she's in a motel somewhere other than in the greater Topeka area. Still, she's sending her story info to either a newspaper or television reporter who's based in Topeka. I have a logic issue here. Peg says Lumen gets control of the cops in City Hall and any area where they have offices. She knows this. If it's true about the cops and city officials, you'd guess they probably also establish contacts and try to curry favor with local media. If Peg wants to get the most play and greatest attention for her story, she should be sending it to a news department located in a city without a Lumen presence. Also, she should probably be looking for a bigger city than Topeka. Kansas City, with a population of 500,000, is just down the road. Since she's already outside of Topeka, it seems like she should be able to send this info anywhere. Instead, she chooses to send it back to Topeka. We're going to find out the story does get squashed in Topeka. There's even a surprise twist as to who quashes it, which signals definite Lumen involvement.
I only wish I could talk to Peggy again, tell her that I was going to get help for her and for all the severed people down there, and that somehow, I'd get the word out about what Lumen is doing.
She knows she can never return to Lumen, so Peggy K no longer exists. Peg says she considered putting this information up on social media, but she figured a news outlet would be a lot faster.
Thank you for your time, Miss Thorne. I look forward to hearing from you as soon as possible.
Peg leaves his cell number and signs off. The next page is an email from Jim M. to Daria T., both with TopekaStar.com email addresses. Jim gets back to her on the morning of November 13th at 10:03 a.m. He says the letter was interesting, but out there. He claims he doesn't have the resources to put on this type of story right now. Plus, he says he called a trusted source at Lumen to ask about severed employee Peg Kincaid. The word from Lumen is Ms. Kincaid was let go because of too many absences. Instead of chasing down this letter, Daria's editor would like to see her focus on the upcoming high school basketball playoffs. He signs his note, "Thanks, Jim." Once again, this letter's timeline is impossible, and I'm convinced no one did any proofreading. In the United States, which would include Topeka, Kansas, the high school basketball season begins in November. It runs through the end of March, and depending on the state, sometimes into early April. It's very clearly November 13th, according to the timestamp on this email. The season is just getting started. The high school basketball playoffs Jim wants reports about won't be happening for at least another 4 or 5 months. You might be saying, hey, couldn't these time differences and logic problems somehow be clues? I don't think so. I'm just sure what we're looking at is a story that was written quickly, rewritten by folks who weren't paying attention to the details, and then released way before it was ready. After spending several hours deconstructing this letter, I have a theory as to where they may have been going with it at one point. If the month on these notes was changed to March instead of November, the whole thing would make a lot more sense. Moving the date on the letter to March would account for the numerous weeks Peg's telling us have passed since November 3rd. March would also actually be basketball playoff time. This letter was released to Apple Books in March. Wouldn't it have made more sense to have had March as a date on those emails? I'm just certain the producers rushed the creation and distribution of this document. They didn't care about the incorrect details or the weird logic holes. They just wanted to get it out the door now. Daria is persistent. She really thinks she's got something with this story. She writes Jim back 5 minutes later, calling the allegations pretty astonishing and asking again if he's sure he wants to pass on this. Jim doesn't respond again until that afternoon at 1:03 p.m. He says it's too late anyway. He attaches an obituary for Margaret Peg Kincaid, 54, of Topeka, Kansas. She died from complications due to a car accident that happened on November 11th. This would be the day after the date on her letter to Daria and 2 days after quitting at Lumen. Her sister Meryl, who was the other Puglish speaker, is listed in the obit as a survivor. We get a few personal details about Peg, including her love of David Niven. A memorial is set for November 20th at 10 a.m. In lieu of flowers, please donate to the Topeka Humane Society. Peg is identified as a school bus driver for, quote, several decades, which seems impossible for a 54-year-old. Tellingly, there is no obituary mention of her 2-year-plus working at Lumen, something else most likely quashed by the Lumen-friendly Topeka Star. Lumen sure seems to know a lot of folks who wind up dying in car accidents. It's also interesting that a professional bus driver with an almost spotless safety record would wind up in a fatal accident. No details as to what happened, but I'm betting it's sketchy. I'm also wondering if Peggy Kincaid has been reanimated somewhere deep beneath the new Topeka location of Lumen. She could now be trapped in the same weird existence as Gemma Scout. What is with Jim saying it's too late? If I were a news editor, this accident, especially the timing, would make me more interested in pursuing the details of the letter. Jim, surprisingly, is on the other side of the fence. He says it's probably for the best. The letter was pretty loose, and they don't want to get into a libel suit with Lumen. He mentions the Nashville Tribune and a story they'd done on Lumen's feeding tube devices. According to Jim, the Nashville paper got sued over what they considered a well-sourced story and were forced to fold 6 months later. The Nashville Tribune, like the Topeka Star, is a fictional newspaper, but there really is a Tennessee Tribune. It covers news in Nashville and Middle Tennessee. The mention of feeding tubes here in the Lexington letter has been linked to the tube we saw in Cobell's Shrine to Kier. Could a person named Charlotte, who was most likely Harmony's mother, aunt, or older sister, have somehow been harmed or killed by the Lumen feeding tubes? Also, do we know anything about these feeding tubes? They might just be standard medical feeding tubes, but I've been wondering if there could be some kind of a productivity thing involved. What if this was some Lumen innovation where workers could be fed while still on a production line? How much more work could you get out of them? No lunch or snack breaks, just keep working, because here comes sustenance through your feeding tube. Jim once again signs off as Jim, but this time his email editor automatically included a signature footer. Are you ready, Refiner? This is the one huge twist in the Lexington letter. The full name of our editor in Topeka is Jim Milchick, with the same spelling as Seth's last name. A coincidence? Not likely, and I dare you to try selling coincidence to thousands of Redditors and Discord users. They will not be buying it. Let's consider Jim Milchick for a moment. He's not working at Lumen, but he is the editor of a newspaper in a town where there's a Lumen location. I'm wondering when Jim got his job in relation to Lumen deciding to locate in Topeka. It's assumed almost unanimously by those who have an opinion on this stuff that Jim is definitely related to Seth Milchick, manager extraordinaire on the severed floor at the Kier PE location of Lumen. How could this be? Well, I have a Milchick family backstory theory. This is just me with no support from anything. You ready? I believe there was a Milchick who fought in the Civil War alongside Keir Egan. Jedediah Milchick was a freed slave who also lived in the Pennsylvania area. He and Keir enlisted at about the same time and formed a bond of brotherhood on the battlefield. When the war was over, Jedediah was approached by his good friend Keir to act as a manager for Keir's new enterprise. Keir became the face of the company, but Jed was the organizational star who helped Lumen grow and expand. The Milchick family has been as closely tied to Lumen throughout the generations as the Egan family. Milchicks have worked behind the scenes as upper-level managers at Lumen since the company's founding. Milchicks have also been pressed into service as corporate spies and, yes, to take on jobs in both media and law enforcement in towns where Lumen has a presence. This Milchick family storyline, copyright 2024 by Alan Stair, all rights reserved. Another possible theory I like, which I found in a random post months ago, says Milchick is the Lumen codename for either a cloning process or a humanoid robot. In this instance, we could say another version of a Milchick clone or robot has been deployed in Topeka. Hey, I didn't say it was a good theory, I just said I liked it. Refiners, I think that's going to do it when it comes to our breakdown and takedown of the Lexington letter. As I mentioned at the top, I don't think the Lex letter is something that should be given too much weight. Sure, it has a couple of fun details. The Jim Milchick reveal is great, but it's really just about explaining the basic severance concept. Some nefariousness does get mixed in. What's happening at the Keir location feels nefarious, but the implication of a truck bombing makes what's happening in Topeka much darker. As for the answers being in the orientation booklet, I'm at a loss, refiners. Unless the answers have something to do with finger traps or pencil erasers, I'm not sure what can be gleaned from the orientation booklet. It's a great piece. I love the retro look of the layout and all of the info, but I didn't get any subtext. There are no secret messages or hidden meanings that I could see. The message of the orientation booklet is very simple and direct, like it was written for elementary age kids. Please, refiners, if you've found any answers in the orientation booklet, don't be shy about sharing. Send those theories and observations to severedpod@gmail.com. A big thanks to my wife, Donna, for taking the time to narrate portions of Peg's letter. Before you hit the elevator, refiner, a reminder about the Severed Patreon page. It's your chance to help me out, support the podcast, and join the fun as a patron refiner. We've got severance talk, behind-the-scenes info, and other goodies you won't get from the regular podcast. Become a patron refiner by going to patreon.com/severedpod. That's patreon.com/severedpod. I'm a recent retiree. I need to supplement my retirement income with this podcasting thing, or I might have to go out and find a real job. I'd rather keep podcasting. Sign up now for only $5 a month, a little bit from a lot of people, is what makes it work. Season 2 keeps getting closer and closer. As of this recording, shooting has moved to the Bell Labs location in Holmdel, New Jersey. This was the last site where they shot for Season 1. It also seems to be the last shooting spot for Season 2. Ben Stiller has said Season 2 shooting should be all wrapped up by April 20th. Post-production will begin in earnest in May. It's possible some CGI work has already been done on existing footage, but the real work of post-production won't get underway until after the field shooting is complete. I'm still optimistic about a late fall release date. My birthday is November 19th. I think Season 2 would make a great birthday present. Between now and then, make sure to keep tabs on the Severed Facebook page. I'll be reporting all the S2 details as soon as I know anything. Close down your workstations, refiners. It's time to call it a day. Exit via the elevator, and remember, as always, please stagger your exits.
You've been listening to Severed, the ultimate severance podcast. Severed is written, produced, and hosted by Alan Stair.
Severed is not endorsed by Red Hour Productions, Endeavor Content, or Apple TV+. This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only.
Severance, the Severance logo, and all video and audio of Severance and Severance characters are registered trademarks of Red Hour, Endeavor Content, Apple TV+, or their respective copyright holders.
Please make sure to leave a 5-star rating and review for Severed at Apple Podcasts.